New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Our topic today is Awakening with Love with my guest, Henry Shookman, who is a teacher in the Zanbo Zen lineage and has trained in various other meditation schools and practices. He has been authorized to teach mindfulness by Shinzen Young and is a certified dreamwork therapist. He is the spiritual director emeritus of Mountain Cloud Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He is also a poet who has been published in the New Yorker and the New York Times. He is the co-founder of the Way app. Henry has authored many books, including Original Love, The Four Inns on the Path of Awakening, One Blade of Grass, Finding the Old Road of the Heart, A Zen Memoir, In Dr. No's Garden, and Mortimer of the Maghreb. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Henry is located in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Henry. It's a great joy to have you with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
Emmy, thank you very much indeed. I'm honored and happy to be a guest.
So I just enjoyed reading your fabulous new book, Original Love. Can you share a little bit about that title and what does that mean?
You know, I personally grew up with a lot of shame. You know, I had a very severe disfiguring skin condition for the first 25 years of my life. And it ebbed and flowed, and sometimes it was really strong and sometimes not so strong. I also had rather a difficult family background with a lot of unhappiness among my parents. And somehow I really felt bad about myself a lot of the time. And I think when I was first exposed to the idea of this thing called original sin, which, you know, we weren't brought up in a faith tradition, actually, but you couldn't help hearing about it, you know, as such a core idea in Judeo-Christian tradition and doctrine. I didn't buy into it, but I actually had bought into it without realizing it, that I had a very deep sense of shame. And when I was lucky enough to start getting into mindfulness and meditation, and even was graced with a sudden moment of what we could call awakening out of the blue when I was 19, I found the utter antidote to shame and the idea of original sin, which was the reality that we totally belong. We're totally wanted by this universe, or we wouldn't be here. And that sense of belonging, you know, in the very fabric of the universe, brought with it this unbelievable sense of love, of belovedness. And as I went into the meditation methods and trainings later on, you know, from my mid-20s onwards, it began to dawn on me that they were actually pointing to something totally different than original sin. And they don't usually call it original love. They might call it original nature, or Buddha nature, or awakened nature. But I felt the best name for it actually is original love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful name. Can we go back to when you were 19 and you had that experience? And can you describe what happened for you?
Like I said, I'd grown up really, oppressed by this skin condition. And I was often hospitalized for it, and I'd had it since I was 6 months old. And I'd also grown up, you know, with a lot of cultural, educational advantages. Both my parents were professors at Oxford University, you know, and there was a very literary and sort of cultured milieu that I grew up in. But it was also strictly sort of rational, logical, you know, empirical. That was a very high value, which I totally absorbed and was okay with, you know. But when I was 18/19, I went away for 6 months actually to work on a ranch in Argentina that a colleague of my father's in his Oxford College was Argentinian, and he found work for me and a friend on this ranch. So it was, you know, like a gap year adventure. And after a couple of months, 3 months of working there, this friend and I backpacked through Bolivia and further, actually. And I wrote my first book while I was doing that. And also, my skin got better. You know, the totally different climate, the totally different diet, the totally different cultural milieu, you know, that we were in there with all these people are living lives so much closer to the land, you know, and actually so much more. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't have thought about it, but so much more centered around well-being, actually, you know, much simpler lives. Babies were totally in contact with the human body nonstop for the first 18 months of their lives. There was a sort of deeper sense of connectedness with the earth, connectedness with one another. And just being around that, my nervous system started to change, you know, and I started to get happier. And the kind of peak of that was this weird moment towards the end of the trip when I was all alone on a beach, looking at the sun looking at the sunlight on the water as the sun was about to set. You know, it was just hanging above the water. And I felt suddenly like I wasn't looking at something outside myself. It was as if suddenly everything flipped or shifted, and I was simply part of what I was looking at. And then that was the sort of first stage. And then the second stage happened where I was just gone. I mean, the me as I knew myself was gone. And I was part of this whole sort of insubstantial field that was everything. And I'm sorry, this is sounding pretty weird, but it was like I and the cosmos were not two things. And it was like I could feel almost, I remember somehow this impression of my nose, the tip of my nose was pressing against the end of time. And the furthest reaches of the universe were right here. And it was all kind of made of these sort of insubstantial sparks that were kind of floating, you know. And by the way, I was stone cold sober, you know.
Right, I know. I was thinking, like, this is what people can describe in psychedelic experiences as well.
Yeah, no, well, this, I'd never done anything like that. And, you know, and I also had this pretty, you know, rational, logical, empirical mindset. So I wasn't interested in spiritual experience or mystical experience. But as I came out of it and realized again, I'm standing on this beach, I was just overwhelmed by this wave of love and beauty. Like this being alive is just the most beautiful thing in the cosmos. You know, just to be a human being, aware, alive, in the world as it looks, you know. It was the total fulfillment of somehow everything, is what it felt like. And actually, I did really feel my life was fulfilled. I could die that night, knowing my life had been completely fulfilled. And, you know, it was, and I knew somehow all of that was real. It was like more real than the normal way I understood and saw things.
It's like sounds like a spontaneous unity of consciousness experience that maybe people who've had near-death experiences describe.
You know, I think that's right. When I read, I don't know if you know that amazing book called My Stroke of Insight by the neurosurgeon.
Yes.
Jill Bolt Taylor just came to me. Yeah. So when I read that, I thought, wow. That's very like what I've experienced. So anybody who hasn't read that, it's a great account of a deep spiritual experience caused by a stroke that knocked out the left hemisphere of her brain, as I remember it.
Well, clearly that's a very beautiful experience. I do know, having read your book, that there's more to the story. Yeah. Because I think those listening might be feeling quite envious, like, how can I have a spontaneous experience of unity consciousness?
Yeah. Right. So a few weeks later, so I did live in a kind of transfigured world, feeling like I was just paper thin and feather light, you know, light as a feather. And the whole world was this beautiful, light-filled, shining, beautiful thing. And where there was suffering, I just spontaneously felt this longing and urge to relieve it any way I could. But then I went home, and almost as soon as I was home, in this very open-hearted state, actually all the trauma of my childhood that I'd somehow managed to compartmentalize and suppress just so that I could kind of get through life when I was younger, suddenly in this really open state, it just swamped me. And it was far too much, far too soon. I got re-traumatized pretty severely. I had a kind of breakdown, you know, lived in despair for really some years, actually. You know, I mean, not constant, but recurring. And by the time I was 24, I started meditating, and I started realizing, boy, I am not happy. And I started doing therapy and essentially a journey of healing. And I'd say also of awakening further, you know, to really go deeper and to really start to actually integrate that experience so it could be more, that experience and more further awakenings, really. You know, but that was a long, long process.
Well, now you are a meditation teacher and a very respected one as well. How do you look upon that experience now? Because it seems like maybe it was planting a very large seed of what is possible for all of us.
You know, I do see it that way. And I think it's kind of true that all of us, you know, it's just like we're a hair's breadth away from a vast, boundless, wondrous reality. And it's always here. And it's like we live, I feel, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's like when you look at the surface of the water with bright light on it, it's, You have no idea that there's depth underneath it, you know? And I feel this world is sort of like that. You know, it is the way it looks, but it's also, that's just the thinnest of thinnest reflections, and just sort of almost behind or within or all through the ordinary experience we're having, which can be, of course, very hard at times and also very beautiful at times, but just kind of, it's suffused with boundlessness that we can learn, we can train actually in ways of being a bit more porous or permeable to the boundlessness. So we're still seeing and what we would be seeing and interacting like we just would, but at the same time, we can come to feel this vast, I don't know, presence of awareness of love, you know, that's not, I think, something we can ever name. It's a mystery.
Clearly, you were on a quest to heal from your past traumas and also to get back to that experience. How long did it take you, or what steps led you back to being able to experience what happened to you when you were 19?
Yeah.
That's me assuming that you have experienced that again, which I think you have.
Yes. I've experienced, that reality has different dimensions. And I've had other experiences of other dimensions. And I feel I've had a deeper experience as well, where sort of everything disappeared. Self and world totally disappeared and then came back different. And something that was the steps, though, were, you know, it's number one, it was starting to meditate for me. And I know that may not be the right way for everybody by any means, but this is what I know, that starting to meditate began to create a space where my nervous system could calm down, which it had been needing to do, you know, for decades, really. Even though that flash of an experience happened, basically my nervous system was very, very fried.
I just want to highlight how your parents not only were professors, but they also had another professional aspect to them that sounds quite intense to grow up with, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, they were both in the field of Russian studies, and this was in the 1960s. I was born in 62, actually. So they were, there were not enough Russian speakers during the Cold War in Britain. And so they got, they were employed by security, you know, intelligence services. And, their three kids, we were just astonished when we learned that later, because they, you know, they led these pretty kind of, quiet, ordinary lives as, you know, academics. But actually they'd had another side too, which had meant a lot of secrecy, even from one another. It was only later that they both knew they were both in it.
Oh, really? Wow.
and that was something. They also, they had a really complicated relationship history as well, that was very difficult for all of us. And, you know, their marriage didn't last, and it was quite bitter and difficult, and it wasn't a nice, comfortable home, basically.
So you yourself didn't really grow up with love per se. Is that right?
Yeah, I've often reflected on that as well. I mean, I definitely grew up with a deficit there, you know, and actually it was when my skin condition, the eczema, was severe, it was really hard to be hugged. It felt really, really bad, you know. So it was very isolating. It was in some ways a blessed childhood and in some ways really quite a difficult one. But I must say, overall, I do look back on it with gratitude, because if those conditions hadn't been like that, I might not have been driven to pursue a path of healing and discovery to the same degree that I was, you know. I also had this kind of explorer / adventurer side to me. I mean, when I was 13, 14, 15, I, with two or three friends during the hot spells in the often not so hot English summers, you know, we would pull on backpacks and just wander out the door and go up the valleys near our home, in a sleep out under trees and in the corners of fields, and make fires and cook sausages, and I had a sort of a love for land, nature, and poetry that developed quite young. And that was I had this ideal of these Chinese poets from, you know, 8th century, 9th century, who were vagabonds. They were wanderers, you know, and often they were meditators. Early Zen started there, you know. And so I kind of had this idea that there's something in this world that you can really explore, and you can get to know the world more intimately. And you can express your love for it with words. You know, that excited me. Mm-hmm. But it took a real knock with that homecoming when I was 19. It was, you know, I was set back by that.
When did you first have your next taste of that love or unity consciousness that you experienced when you were 19? What path did you carve for yourself that developed that or other experiences that also now has led you to become a teacher?
Like I mentioned, I did start meditating very religiously, twice a day without fail, when I was 24. And then I was lucky enough, actually, a few years later, to get exposed to some Zen, which was just a friend reading to me some weird Zen writing that I didn't understand. But I knew that what that writer was saying, I suddenly sensed it had to come out of that same experience I'd had on the beach. And I got this hunch. Zen knew about that type of experience. And I was right. And so a couple of years on, I was doing my first week-long retreat. And man, it was hard. It was brutal. I found it. It was torture for me. But then suddenly, towards the end of it, I had this amazing moment when I, as a self, I just disappeared. And I realized I'd never really been the self I thought I was, not really. And with that sense of self gone, everything was perfect. Everything was so beautiful. And it was different from the previous experience, but it was another dimension of the same level of reality, you know. And so that kind of encouraged me to keep going in the meditative path, not just for emotional regulation and stabilization of my nervous system and so on, but also as a path of discovery and awakening. And I was really lucky. I've somehow collided with some amazing teachers who just profoundly helped me on this path.
Would you like to share some of your teachers?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be quite a long list, so I'll keep it brief. There's Roshi Joan Halifax has been a Zen teacher who's helped me so much. John Gaynor, another Zen teacher in the UK, is just the most amazing man. Very ordinary guy, you know, you wouldn't know he was a Zen teacher at all. He dresses perfectly normally. He runs two charities for severely disabled people. Joan Rick Roshi, another Zen teacher. Ruben Habito is a professor of comparative religion in Dallas, a Southern Methodist University, and a meditation teacher. Powerful, profound guy. And Yamada Roshi, who's, as you might guess, from Japan, who I periodically still get to meet with. And he actually sort of authorized me personally as a Zen teacher, you know. And also Shinzen Yang, who's a meditation general mindfulness teacher. I got very deep with Shinzen. I love his work. Quite a number of others, you know, dream therapy guides and shamanic guides. And I've been, different kinds of therapy have helped me. I've sampled quite widely, I think.
Yeah. You've absorbed a lot from many different people.
Yes. I think it's taken that, actually.
Well, before we get into the four ends to the path of awakening, what is awakening?
Yeah. You know, of course, it can mean many different things, and someone wants it to mean, I think it's just fine. The sense that I'm mostly using it in the book is what the deep ancient meditation traditions use it to mean, which is typically one or both of two things. One is kind of a revelation about the nature of self, that the separate sort of beleaguered, besieged self that we commonly might feel we are, that's, you know, intrinsically trying to navigate this world to protect itself and get what it wants and needs and keep away what it doesn't want. That sense of self in some ways is an illusion. And we see the ways in which it's an illusion. That's one side of awakening. So suddenly it's a discovery about the nature of self. But at the same time, because of that, really, it's also a discovery about our relationship to everything else, which is one of inseparability, of utter connectedness. And like you said, perfectly, unity. You know, that's, so I think in most traditions that go into it would agree on those two sides.
How do you navigate or go forward as a human self that on some levels is separate from others, but at the same time, very inseparable from others and the all?
Yeah, I love that question. Thank you. I sort of feel in a way there's two great gifts. You know, one is the great gift of discovering our boundless unity with everything, and that's what we really are. And then the other great gift is the opportunity to be precisely the person that we are, which is presumably unrepeatable. That exactly this person with exactly these conditions, exactly right now, is getting this opportunity to exist. So that also is an infinite gift. So I think, you know, over time, I feel both sides are absolutely critical. And yeah, probably in the end, they're not really two. They're really one anyway. And it depends which way the light is coming, which side we see. But I think they both are great gifts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can, you know, what will help this particular being to flourish and really become what it wants to grow into, you know, and you know, commonly, you know, there's some amount of self-care in that, and there's also usually some amount of service in that as well. It seems like I don't know if this is like a law or anything, but it seems like the happiest people end up kind of serving while not neglecting self-care as well. You know, because if we're in a life of service, it's so easy to neglect self-care and end up burning out.
Right. Perhaps it's giving and receiving love that we're all a part of.
Oh, I love that. I agree. Yeah. I think I have this sort of feeling that I wanted to convey actually in the book, that like I mean, you know, we should each all ask ourselves if it's true for us. But I find that when my theory is that when we're experiencing any degree of love, you know, and I don't mean like kind of craving. I mean, love, you know, cherishing, appreciating, gratefully acknowledging and welcoming and wishing well for, that kind of love, even the tiniest little grain or drop of it does something to us. It's a reset. It's an opening. It's a, I don't know, it somehow, don't we sort of expand or open or something loosens or with just the tiniest taste of that? So I think that's what we're made to experience, really.
I think it was Rumi who said something like, your task is not to seek for love, but find the barriers that keep you from it.
He's always right.
So even going back to you describing that cold home environment you grew up in and how something opened in you and showed you this is really what you can feel like all the time.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think in a way, I mean, whatever the reasons are that we have the obstacles that we have, if we work with them as gifts, you know, as invitations, as pathways, as doorways, something flips and we can even love them because of what they help us find.
Yeah, it can be difficult when people have come from a background of abuse or neglect, having maybe still, they might still be experiencing trauma or even PTSD, to look at those experiences that way. But you're suggesting that this can deepen our relationship with ourselves if we have the opportunity to look at it like that.
Yeah, I do. But I would actually totally agree with you very much. Thank you for bringing that up. That, you know, the timing of doing that kind of thing is critical. There'll be times when it's really counterproductive. And it may just grow in its own time that we see things that way. But that's one of the things that I really like about meditation is that it's slow and patient. You know, there may be kind of occasional dramatic shifts, but a lot of it is just slow, patient, coming to terms with ourselves, you know, and becoming more patient with what we think we might not like about ourselves.
Right. And what you're describing sounds like mindfulness, which is the first in you describe.
Yes, yes. It's sort of patiently developing the capacity to be with our experience, kind of almost whatever it is, in with an attitude of allowing. And that's more or less, I think most mindfulness teachers would sign off on that, more or less, as a description. But it seems to be very much about being with our experience, both outward and inward. So we're getting to know our emotional life. We're getting to know our psychological life, our cognitive and mental life. We're becoming more able to kind of calmly witness that. And we're also, because of that, we're more able to appreciate external experience. Simply finding, for no particular reason, wow, I like looking at this day. I like walking outside and it's morning and may not be especially remarkable in any way. It's just another normal day on our street and it's lovely. You know, that I think that's a fruit of mindfulness. Because we're living more in the here and now and not so much in imaginings and planning or in memories and, you know, be they good or bad. We're more inhabiting the richness of here and now.
And for some people, when they begin meditation, or even they might have a start and stop or sporadic practice, and they might have an intention to meditate more, or to get that quiet time for themselves, or prayer, whatever that quiet time is for a person, that those areas where we can tend to be self-critical or judge ourselves can bubble up to the surface. And through mindfulness, we can learn more self-compassion, more self-love, and self-acceptance.
I 100% agree. That was certainly the case for me. I could notice my self-condemnation, you know, and self-criticism, harshness, much more. Though I will say, certainly in my own case, and probably for some number of, maybe a good number of others, it really helped me to do some therapy as well. And I think it's a potent combination.
So you did both. You did mindfulness and you also went to a therapist.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I really think they go together awfully well, actually. I think therapy is helped by it, and I think mindfulness is helped by therapy for those that need it. Of course, not everybody by any means needs it, I'm sure, but some of us will realize we do. And the sitting itself on a daily basis may show that to us. Just because we're being quiet with ourselves, we might start to notice, boy, I'm commonly not feeling very happy. You know, I've got this anxiety that every time I look, it's there, you know, or I've got this shame that I, again, every time I look, it's there. And the meditation will reveal that. And yeah, it can be enough for some just to learn a meditative path of allowing and welcoming and being with. And then self-compassion starts to emerge, and self-love, and it starts to melt these conditioned things in our psyches. But for others, man, a bit of therapy can be instrumental. Yeah.
How do you typically, well, you just described some of this, but how do you typically guide people in mindfulness? Or can you give some suggestions now? I know it can be helpful to actually have a teacher and that, but I'm just wondering if you could give us a little taste of that for the viewers and listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will just say that actually after years of teaching in person, the last few years I've been doing much more online, and we've even created an app now that is a single pathway of guidance in all of these inns that we'll be talking about. But my main effort really with folks who are either very familiar with meditation or just totally new to it is it's really about coming home. And it's sort of, it's how do we build a sense of home, meaning a place where we don't have to be anything. We don't have to perform. We don't have to measure up. We don't have to live up to anything. We're already welcome the moment we walk in the door. Now, I must say, as a kid, I didn't particularly feel that, but I've created it for myself now, both materially, concretely in the world, but also in my own being. And I believe all of us have this capacity, this sort of level of our being, where we know how to be at home with ourselves. And yes, it may be occluded in some ways, but I'm trying to, just with little hints and nudges and little guideposts, trying to help us to come back to that. And that's the foundation of, that's the home base for meditation. And everything else we do is helping us come back to that. So, you know, sometimes it's just, yeah, people are restless. They can't find that. That's okay. Then we look at restlessness. What actually is it? How do you know you're feeling restless. Well, there's this churning sensation in my chest, let's say. Okay, so let's just be still and let's feel the whole body. The feet are fine. They haven't got a churning sensation. Actually, the legs don't have it. Hands don't have it. Forearms and upper arms, they don't have it either. Quite a lot of the body does not have that. But yeah, there's this area in the chest. And this is an example where, yeah, there's this churning feeling of restlessness. So what we're going to do is gently invite a capacity for being present, you know, with our what we're hearing, what we're seeing, and what we're sensing in all the rest of the body, and have all of that gently hold the uneasy part so that we're not trying to get rid of it. We're letting it know it's wanted, it's welcome, it's okay that it's showing up.
Now, you just said a key word there, it's wanted. So we're accepting the restlessness versus rejecting it.
Yes, exactly.
And that can be challenging when we have feelings that feel uncomfortable.
Exactly. So we come at it very gently. If we need to, we kind of titrate, just bit by bit, bit by bit. We get settled in what feels good, and then let's allow in a little touch of this area that doesn't feel so good. And then back to what feels good. And we just gently start letting them know each other. And typically, something lightly shifts. We're generally moving toward the condition or the state of allowing.
And you're bringing another form of being or presence or consciousness that is not being caught up in, for example, the restlessness. You're bringing something else to it. So then it has a chance to be accepted, perhaps transformed.
Exactly. So yeah, my experience is that we all have kind of more in our awareness than we realize, myself included, you know. And the meditation is more about uncovering what's already there than it is about sort of engineering what we think we might want.
Henry, what does it feel like, or what is your experience like when you come home to yourself?
It's always a kind of relief. Something releases. There's a loosening and a kind of enriching. That's somehow, it may be very gentle and even subtle or quite soft, but there's a sense of appreciation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just talked about the first in, and the second in is support. What kind of support can we gather on this path?
Yeah. I thanks for bringing it up. I see it as a critical thing in the world of meditation, particularly, because so many people have sort of ideas about meditation as a solitary pursuit. You know, we have some kind of archetype or ideal of the hermit on the mountaintop. You're up there alone, you know. But really, there's so many ways that this path of growth, with meditation as a thread in it, is about connecting. It's about, you know, first of all, there's just connecting with the body, with my own body. There's connecting with the space around me. And of course, many kinds of connection with other people. There's connecting with very tangible kinds of support in the form of guides and guidance. Especially, there's so much guidance available these days, you know. of many flavors to suit all of us, really. And just being able to reach out for help. I believe that there's some level of our psyche or consciousness, perhaps it's like Jung's collective unconscious, where there's a ton of connection going on. And that, you know, we may tap into it in our dreams. We may, you know, if anybody's interested in hypnotherapy or in shamanic journeys. And I mean, without compounds, just with a drum or whatever methodology is used, I think all of that is just a great way to tap into a world of connectedness. You know, I used to teach poetry at the Institute of American Indian Arts here in Santa Fe. They were mostly Native or Indigenous students. And it was fascinating because so many of them were leading ostensibly kind of normal lives. They might have a job at Starbucks, drive a car, have an apartment, come to college. But they'd go home periodically to a reservation somewhere, and they might fast for 4 days with all their cousins and then dance in costume for a whole day, you know, and they were going through these deeply transformative ceremonial rituals of different kinds that were really taking them to another realm of connectedness. You know, one student, she had a word in her one of her poems in an indigenous language, and I asked her, what does that mean? And she said, oh, that's the name of my whale song. And I said, what do you mean your whale song? She said, well, once a year, we all paddle out into the sound. This is in the Pacific Northwest. And we go to meet our ancestors, the whales. And they come and meet us. And sometimes a whale gives someone a song. And that was the song I was given. You know, I thought, wow. It's, you know, it's a deep, connected life we're part of. You know? And I think meditation can help us open to it if we want it to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the second in is more about.
Yeah. So support from ourselves, people, maybe our spiritual or religious practices, because one can have a meditation practice and also belong to some particular religion if they so choose. And also other creatures,
yes.
Nature. And of course, we are part of nature.
Yes, exactly. 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 And really recognizing that, you know, we can meditate to recognize more clearly how much we're part of this planet.
Yes. When I asked you about what home feels like to you, it sounds like you were talking about the third in you described, perhaps, where you talk about absorption. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. Well, there's an experience or set of experiences in meditation that's usually known as samadhi. And it's a difficult word to translate, but it's pretty much like absorption. And what that is like is what is known as flow states. When we get into flow, you know, it could be through all manner of activities, but flow is, and there's some great research on this since the 1970s, actually, that, you know, when we're engaged in a really a whole array of different kinds of activity, we may get into this lovely sort of special state of mind where time kind of flies by and we don't notice it, where we feel deeply absorbed in what we're doing. We're not so self-conscious. Often whatever it is, we're doing it kind of better than we normally do, you know, and it feels very fulfilling. And so all of those characteristics actually fit really well with the meditative condition known as samadhi. So I consider that to be basically like a flow state in meditation. And it's beautiful when it comes on, you know, because people often report it quite early on in practice. They've been struggling to do whatever the particular guidance might be, and then all of a sudden it's so easy, and it feels beautiful. And then they think, wow, this feels great, and it disappears, you know. Or they think, I really want that again, and they can't get it back, you know. That's quite common. But so this third in is about that. It's about getting more absorbed in here and now, finding a great beauty in the world, you know, in our experience, here and now.
Mm-hmm. Not thinking about the past or the future, which can be tricky, right? And we do need time to recollect our experiences, events, and memories. And of course, even all the way to our ancestral lineage. There's a lot of value in that. And also to think about the future for planning. But through meditation, we can take a break and come back to ourselves.
Yes, yes, yes. And actually in Zen, they say sort of, when... it's fine to plan, and when planning, just be totally planning, you know, be wholeheartedly in planning. But actually, most of us need to do a little bit of work to be getting more consistently here and not in planning, not in memory, but to really living right here.
Right, in the present moment, which can be challenging for some people because there's so much going on in our consciousness that we talked about earlier. And so through these various methods that you teach, people can learn to love, accept themselves, and come home to themselves like you described.
Yes, exactly. And then this sort of shift can happen where we're just so at home in this very moment, you know, and it's very fulfilling just to be doing kind of nothing, you know, just sitting still quietly. Somehow that just being can become a profoundly fulfilling thing. You know, so I love that because we normally think we've got to have this, we've got to have that, so I can feel fulfilled, you know. And this is about finding, you know, really beautiful fulfillment of self, of being, just by being, by not doing.
Yeah. I believe it was Mihai Csikszentmihalyi who wrote the book Flow and did a lot of research on those flow states and how people can get into that as you're describing through meditation. I feel very in flow with you in this conversation. I'm doing my best to just be present and just allow whatever comes up to come up, even though I have some prepared questions. And the more that we can love and accept ourselves can be a direct reflection also of how we can treat others as well. What have you found over the years with your students, yourself and your students, with how their lives have changed by taking these steps?
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. There's one student, she's a university professor, and she'd been working in this kind of way on our programs for just 2 years, actually, and feeling so fulfilled in doing that. And really coming to some beautiful shifts. And she decided to put all the money she'd saved up into a home for her brother-in-law and several other people who were severely disabled and needed a specially designed home to live in. She just said, why am I keeping this money? I'm just going to give it away for that. And another guy's a kind of a stressed-out chef with an amazing restaurant on the West Coast, and he just said, I'm going to have a total mindfulness program for all my staff, anybody who wants to come. We're always going to pause, gather, be a team together with some simple mindfulness. And that's a part of the daily routine there.
I'm actually married to a chef. What did that do to the restaurant staff when he did that?
Well, they're much happier. He's happier, as the boss, and they're all happier. There's a place of meeting outside of the madness. Because I mean, I've worked in restaurants. I know way back. I know that there's a period in a busy restaurant when it's kind of mad. I mean, you can hardly keep up. Things are happening so fast, but they get into a collective state of being together in stillness, in quiet, in peace. And just hitting that on a regular basis, needn't even be for very long. It makes a world of difference, because there's a different reference point. You know, it's not like now it's a slow, chill restaurant. They don't function well or something.
Everybody's just going to sit back and sip tea on these cushions, although those can be nice restaurants as well.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just recognizing, oh, wow, there is a space that I personally can find, or that we as a team can find, where we can be quiet. And it's not like just I'm biting my tongue. No, it's like actually I'm finding a condition that's quiet, that's peaceful.
And then they can connect with themselves and connect with each other and perhaps be in a flow state as they're humming along together as an organism serving, and then also with this public, the people they're serving.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, as the app I mentioned earlier, The Way, you know, we have a little team and we don't meet without at least a minute or five of quiet together. And it really, it's just great for, I don't know, a sense of, you could say team building, sure, but it's also just being humans together, you know, that it's a reminder of that we're trying to offer something helpful.
In our meetings at New Thinking Aloud, we do this as well. And it, in a basic level, one could kind of consider it as sort of like hitting the reset button rather than kind of flying in and trying to hit the ground running. You can pause for a moment, kind of gather yourself, and then be more intentional. And experiences could be more smooth then going forward.
Yes, exactly. I think it's super healthy for all levels, for self, for team, for family, for community, for nation, you know, and for world. Yeah.
Definitely. So your third in absorption is being in love with the now, being present and okay with what's happening now. Obviously, if there's something to be afraid of or if there's something to protect yourself from, then you can be aware of that. But we're just kind of talking generally going through your day. And what I also really value about mindfulness, I practice mindfulness myself, is that it's something that you can practice, as one might say, on and off the mat, that you can have your sitting time and then you can also take it into your daily life as well.
100%. And, you know, some would say that's what we're really kind of training for, you know, that it's great that we, you know, we can find spaces of peace and quiet in our meditation. But actually, there's more, because we want to be living it. There's one teacher around, Shinzen Young, actually, who has this chart of grades of difficulty of being mindful. The easiest is when sitting in meditation. And then it goes to like walking, and then it goes to eating, and then it goes to cooking. And then the top one is an extremely aggressive, verging on violence, confrontation with somebody who's furious. Can we stay equanimous, mindful, aware, non-reactive if somebody's really aggressively in our face yelling at us?
Many of us have those experiences on a daily basis, or maybe weekly, with maybe certain family members, maybe out in your community, or even at work or school.
Yeah, I know. It's very sad that we do, you know. And I think that the spread of this kind of simple practice that has no beliefs attached to it. You know, it's not, you don't have to sign on for anything. You just do it. If you want to do it, you just do it, you know, and you need very little to do it. You don't actually have to go anywhere. You want to have a reasonably quiet space that you can be in for 10 or 20 minutes or whatever time you have. And then you're just being with yourself. And I think the more this can spread, the more the norms of society can change, where actually, you know, we understand negative emotion better. We understand its origins and its causes and conditions. And we're less likely to react ourselves to it, you know. And I hope we're moving towards shifts in society where, you know, we're just more compassionate and humane across the board.
Do you think that how we regard ourselves and the level to which we're compassionate and loving with ourselves, we are with others as well?
I actually believe that wholeheartedly. I think it's really, it's a tricky thing because I do know people who are really service-based and no way would we want them to shift from that. But there can be a kind of sternness in there that is associated with not deep self-acceptance or self-compassion or self-love. I mean, it's not a rule of thumb or anything, but I think it's something to watch for all of us, that we don't somehow overlook our own need for self-love. You know, and I think if we're kind to ourselves, then kindness to others is just an extension of that. It's a natural flowering or outpouring of a love that we're already feeling.
And just to be clear, I think you and I know this, but those listening, just to be clear, we're not talking about a narcissistic type of love. We're talking about more of a kind appreciation, or how would you describe the kind of love we're talking about?
Yeah, I'd call it a sort of kind regard for ourselves. You know, I think narcissism is often based on shame, that I've got to get people to look at me and admire me, and regardless of what, because I don't know how to do it myself. You know, and the more I do it myself, actually, the less my concern with how others view me can develop.
Because you get more comfortable and at home with yourself. Of course, you can be kind and respectful to others, but you're able to just be who you are.
Yes, you don't need them for your own self-respect. Because kind of, if you do, you haven't really got self-respect, you know, and self-appreciation.
Yeah. What does the research say about how long it might take for somebody to attain the benefits? I know this is kind of a Western way of viewing this, but I know there are people listening thinking, yeah, I'm not feeling great, or I feel good some days and not other days, or part of the day I'm okay and part of the day I'm not, and I really would like to feel better. What can you share with them about that?
Yeah, well, I'll say that, you know, here's some thoughts around that. One would be, you know, I'm afraid I'm still advocating for meditation here, because this one of the advantages of it is if we establish a daily practice, that means we're going to do it regardless every day. Some days it might be just restless, uncomfortable the entire time, and we still do it. And we get up and we might not feel a great shift, but something registers, I believe, in our unconscious. That our unconscious knows it was granted 20 minutes or whatever the time was, 10 minutes of stillness and quiet when we weren't actively doing anything. And that accrues, that accumulates as a value, that we're building this level of our awareness. We're drawing it forth bit by bit, just by being still and quiet for a piece of each day. It actually isn't. Yeah, there's one side of meditation which is to some extent mechanical. Do these practices and you'll probably feel a bit calmer. Okay. But there's this other level I'm talking about now where just the doing of it day in, day out is actually paving the ground for gradually developing a kind of different kind of awareness that is more closely aligned with the miracle that we exist at all.
That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. Right. And from a materialistic perspective, an analogy may be that it's like exercising for cardiovascular health or for physical strength, that the more you do it, the benefits just improve. And I believe there is neuroscience research that shows that there's thickening of the cortex and people can experience benefits with increased focus, attention. I think there's even some evidence that shows that it can improve your ability with executive functioning, with thinking and cognition as we go on in life. So people who have a regular meditation practice, yourself included, and I would be in that camp as well, would likely have healthier brains. Not that it's all about neuroscience. I certainly understand that, but that's another way to look at this.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful paper by a friend of mine called James Austin, who's a tremendous pioneer in the neuroscience of meditation. He wrote a book way back called Zen Brain and has updated it every few years for decades now. He's getting on. And one of his papers was about increase in telomere length in cells, you know, that tail of the DNA or whatever it is, the telomere, which shortens over age over time. Long-term meditators actually had, you know, compared with control groups of their age, longer telomeres. So in other words, their cognitive function in their brains this is in brain cells, in neurons, was definitely, it seemed from this research, sustained, promoted, increased over longevity, you know, through practicing. And that kind of endorses, you know, in the history of meditation, there are these, you know, these revered old masters who lived to 100 and so on. That actually, there's something to it that, you know, long-lived, quiet, you know, less stressed individuals who are, you know, living in quite harmonious lives in their community and harmonious in terms of their footprint in the earth, in the world, you know, they could actually be pretty sharp mentally and full of wisdom into very old ages. You know, there's one old Zen master that is revered in the Zen tradition called Jiaozhou, who lived to 120. And it's documented, you know, Chinese kept very good records, and he really did. And he was teaching in his last days.
It really does provide another incentive for those who are interested in what we're offering here, what you're talking about here today. And before we wrap up, can you share a little bit about how much time a person needs to sort of log, if you will, or what is a kind of a general suggested amount of time for meditation? I know it's also the quality, and I think you mentioned that in your book, even just starting with 5 minutes a day is a great way to begin.
I do think there's no, you know, total answer. There's no ultimate answer. On our app, we have three options: 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes for each daily sit. And I would strongly recommend that a beginner not do more than 10 a day, even if they get very enthused, you know, which does happen. What we want is to do it every day. So, you know, we might think, oh man, I love this, and do 40 minutes one day and then not do any for 3 days, or do 40 minutes for 3 days and then a week off. It's much better to do 10 minutes every single day. And if we've done that for 2 months, for example, then we might say, okay, I want to go to 15, you know, or I want to go to 20. And we try that. And if we start missing days, boom, we go back to 10. So that's the dailiness of it is really the thing.
The last inn you describe in your book is awakening. And again, if you could just share a little bit about what we're awakening to and what that inn is all about.
This would be harking back a bit to what we were saying earlier about the sense of self, that to awaken, you know, that there are different traditions do view it in different ways, but in the common shared view among all traditions of awakening is that we discover that our sense of self as being thoroughly separate from all else has been an illusion, and that we are actually free of it. And when we're free of it, we find a boundless union with everything else.
Beautiful. Yes. And that seems to be what all the world's mystical and spiritual traditions teach, and also what we talk a lot about here on New Thinking Aloud from that parapsychological perspective of people having, which I know can develop more for people through meditation as well, is having more, some might refer to it as ESP, extrasensory perception, intuition, psychic functioning. Creativity can increase. There's a lot that really goes on with that. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on those abilities.
I think just a quick comment on the first part of what you said is that all these different traditions speak to it, I think, because it's just real, you know. And the question is how much a tradition places that at the foreground of what it's trying to share or not, you know, because all institutions can have their problems, you know, at different times, and same with traditions. They'll be more on it and less on it, more caught up in corporate concerns, but the heart of our human life, I believe, is this reality of oneness, of original love, you know. And I think on that basis, you know, why wouldn't we be able to sort of know these things that, you know, are coming from more than the confines of our own skull, you know? And I think intuition is, I don't know if it's occasionally it misleads. What, it's not really intuition, it's something else. You know, discerning what is intuition is a thing, I think. But I really do believe that we get nudges and hints and pointers and all the time if we're open to them.
Yeah. Have you found that develop in your own life over time?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I'm quite often sitting and something comes and Oh, that's exactly what I was sort of wondering about. And the answers just come. Or, you know, some message just... My Zen master, Yamada Roshi, who I mentioned before, he'll say he often gets the email while he's sitting.
I love that.
You know, that you just... It comes.
Yeah, like a telepathic insight or message or knowing or awareness.
Yeah, and yeah, I think many meditators would report an increase in that.
Henry, is there anything else you want to share today about awakening with love?
I hope we all find it.
Hmm. Yeah. Me too, which is why I'm so grateful to have you as a guest here today. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation where we're going to talk about Zen and koans as well.
It's so kind of you to have me on the show, Emmy, and I've loved this conversation. I'm much looking forward to the next as well.
Well, me as well. Thank you so much for all that you've shared here today. And thank you for being with me, Henry. It's been a great joy and pleasure.
Great. Thanks to you.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. ¶¶
2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.